This message comes from NPR sponsor FX, presenting Clipped, the story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. Streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
The Mossad is the Israeli version of the CIA. Think top secret spies, agents who deny they work there. So I was surprised to learn that there has been a tradition where one day a year, the Mossad throws open its doors to the families of the employees.
And the kids used to come.
Wait, the Mossad has take your son or daughter to work day?
Yeah, why not?
Avner Abraham is a former Mossad agent with a passion for history. He would set up these elaborate exhibits for the kids with, say, a typewriter from the 50s that typed in Morse code or old spy gear.
Like you have television, but inside you can find camera. I think that old objects got energy.
One day, a top guy told him he had something to show him in a refrigerated archive in the Mossad basement.
It was in the corner.
10 boxes of stuff, all from one old operation.
It looks like someone said, okay, let's put everything in boxes and put it in the corner and don't touch it for 50 years.
Avner finds an old Leica camera, a kit to make fake license plates, a pocket diary in code.
I remember that I opened one of the envelopes, a brown envelope, and I saw old Israeli passports from the 50s.
Israeli passports from the 50s had blue cloth and gold letters. He opens one of them. The name is in Hebrew.
Ze'ev Zichroni. If you translate Ze'ev, is wolf, and Zichroni is memory.
The wolf of my memory. It's a code name. The picture on the passport is Adolf Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann was Hitler's mastermind of transportation. He made sure the trains to the death camps ran smoothly. And after the war, he escaped to Argentina until he was captured by the Mossad and brought to Israel. And his trial, in Jerusalem in 1961, was broadcast all around the world.
When I stand before you, judges of Israel.
People crowded around their radios and TVs.
To accuse Adolf Eichmann.
More than 100 Holocaust survivors took the stand to tell their stories.
I do not stand alone.
At the time, most people had never heard these stories in public. And in Israel, which was full of refugees, telling these stories was taboo. They didn't fit with Israel's self-image of resistance and strength. The survivors were seen as victims. They were called lambs to the slaughter. And lambs don't speak. The Eichmann trial became the setting to flip that script. Victims became prosecutors of the Nazi in the dock.
Here with me at this moment stand 6 million prosecutors.
The Eichmann trial gave Israel a new story to tell about a nation that had suffered a wrong and was ready and able to exact justice. And it created the legend of the Mossad, this young spy agency from a tiny new country that discovered Eichmann was hiding under a false name in Argentina, then tracked him, staked him out in his home, kidnapped him, sedated him, dressed him in a flight crew uniform, and snuck him onto a plane to Israel with Argentine authorities none the wiser. This is the capture story that would be told and retold in books and documentaries and feature films and taught in Israeli high schools. And the agents became national heroes with books and memoirs of their own. That's the story that Avner found in these basement boxes. And he's asked to make a show for the public, the first museum exhibit by the Mossad about itself. Some Mossad PR at a moment when the Mossad is being especially criticized for secret assassinations. And his exhibit, it's a hit. It goes up in Jerusalem, and then Tel Aviv, and then they're invited to Cleveland, and then Skokie, Illinois, and New York City, and Florida, and New Orleans, and everywhere he goes, this odd thing happens. He's approached by people who say, you forgot to include my dad.
Why didn't you write the name of my father? All the years he used to say that he was one of the people that captured Eichmann. We know he took part. He was there. He was in the car.
One guy's dad booked hotel rooms for the agents. Someone's mom had a backup safe house. A guy in New York had the job of going to the post office each day to take all the mail from the Argentine sources and put it in a new envelope for Tel Aviv.
It's amazing. All the time. There's someone in the audience that have a connection.
Everyone wanted a piece of this story. Everyone, that is, except one person, who was closer to the heart of this capture than anybody else. And yet, he did not want any part of this story.
My father didn't want to talk about anything.
I'm Gregory Warner. This is Rough Translation, the show that takes you to far-off places with stories that hit close to home. This season of Stories, it's been all about rebels. We've brought you stories of people challenging government corruption in Iraq, others trying to rewrite the French language. This story, it's about a different kind of rebellion, a quieter kind. Because you'd think if you were part of something big and important to your nation, you would want your name in the history books. Today, we meet someone who did completely the opposite, erased himself from the story. And his kids would spend years asking themselves, why? Arguing about it. And some of those arguments revolved around just one object, an object that Avner, the Mossad curator, was trying to hunt down.
This mission to bring the needle.
Rough Translation, back after a break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor FX, presenting Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
We're back with Rough Translation, and our story is about the doctor who injected the sedative into Eichmann's arm and then accompanied him through the airport in Buenos Aires, both men dressed in flight crew uniforms with starched white shirts, blue trousers, Stars of David on their caps. This was, in a sense, the trickiest part because they had to pass Eichmann off to airport authorities as just a member of the crew who was feeling sick.
That's why the doctor was with him. He need to keep him like a puppet.
What does that mean, like a puppet?
Like he's not sleeping. He cannot speak. He cannot scream. He looks very sick.
And in 1960, with the anesthetics of that time, was that difficult to do? To put him in exactly that twilight?
That's why he was a professional.
His colleagues considered him this magician. He was a legend in his field.
Daniel Estrin, Jerusalem correspondent for NPR, has been digging into the doctor's story.
He was the anesthesiologist who would be called upon whenever a baby, even a preemie, needed to be operated on. The doctor died some years ago, but I know he would not have talked to me anyway. He probably would have shut me out, as he did everyone who wanted to hear his story. So I ended up meeting with his son Danny in a noisy Tel Aviv cafe. Danny spent his life trying to figure out his father's mystery. Danny's a trim guy in his 60s. He's got two kids. He's a cardiologist. Like his dad, he loves the artifacts of his profession. He actually has a collection of heart stents. He's removed from patients' bodies and mounted. He calls it the world's largest collection. The hospital where he works is the same one where his dad was the director of the anesthesiology department. They call him Elian number 2.
Elian the second. I mean, it's really funny. I'm 31 years in the hospital. I'm still considered the son of Dr. Elian here.
As a kid, Danny remembers his father being gone a lot. He was always on call, traveling to different hospitals around Israel. But one of those trips, Danny remembers when he was 8 years old.
He woke me up early in the morning as a little kid and sort of kissed me goodbye. And he told me he was going to Eilat.
Eilat is about 4 hours south of Tel Aviv, but he was gone for weeks.
And I have this really strong memory. When he came back, he gave me a pistol.
A toy pistol.
And the butt of the pistol was from ivory. And I was like, wow, they have such beautiful things in Eilat. I was shocked.
Yeah. Right. My brother remembers the pistol, yeah. And I remember getting a doll.
Danny has a twin sister named Miri Halpern-Verny. And she also remembers this trip, and she remembers the gifts. What was the doll that you remember?
Just a doll that a girl likes. I didn't have many dolls.
Miri, as a kid, was more into soccer than dolls. But even she had the same reaction as her brother. Like, wow, you can buy such beautiful things in Israel?
In Israel, 50 years ago, you could not get things so easily like you get now. So these were very small signs that something maybe not usual is going on.
You mean that there may be more to your father than you realize?
Yeah.
They didn't even know which country those gifts had come from until they were teenagers in high school. and Danny was hanging out with some friends, and they're talking about the Eichmann capture.
I mean, a group of friends were kind of talking and something about Eichmann, and one of them turned to me and said, maybe this is your father, who is the doctor involved.
Danny had no clue what this kid was talking about. Had one of his father's long trips been for the Mossad to sedate and kidnap a well-known Nazi? Danny gets home from school and he asks his dad, Dad, did you, Eichmann, did you do that? And he was like, yeah.
In his very sort of typical, nonchalant way, he, you know, kind of acknowledged it and just moved on.
Repeatedly we asked and he didn't want to share any information. He said, it's my right not to say anything to anybody.
This silence provoked almost opposite reactions in his two children, the twins. While her brother went to med school and became Elian number two, Miri left Israel and she stopped asking her dad questions.
He was not a storyteller at all. He was very quiet. I don't like the limelight either. He just didn't like. Some people like it, he doesn't. He didn't. Why? He must have had his reasons.
Miri says in Israel, where military service is mandatory, many people have done things that they just can't talk about in public.
In Israel, everybody's involved in these things, in the Mossad. Everybody has kind of secret activities. It's not that unusual.
What do you mean, everybody's involved in the Mossad?
Many people are involved in the Mossad in Israel.
Did you work for the Mossad?
No, and if I would, I wouldn't tell you.
Unlike his sister, Danny was not the type to let secrets lie.
Many times I asked him, Abba, why won't you talk about this? What's so secret? Everybody knows about it, so what's the big deal?
His father did eventually give him one answer.
He would talk about that as a doctor, he didn't feel quite right about using his knowledge, his power, against somebody's will. It's against the Hippocratic Oath.
The Hippocratic Oath. The pledge that med students take that a doctor should first do no harm to their patients. Danny is a doctor himself. He could agree that, yes, technically his father had brought harm to Eichmann, sedated him against his will.
I told him, I understand the argument, but the Hippocratic Oath is, I mean, it's so unfitting for the situation. And I told him, Abba, this is not just any person. This is Eichmann we're talking about, a mass murderer, mass killer. But he was adamant about that.
It seemed like his dad might have regretted his role in this historic mission. In the cafe, I asked Danny about that, about his dad's regret. He did not like that word.
I just don't feel like he regretted it. Regret is just not the right word. Absolutely not. I never heard him say, I regret.
He says the headline here is not, Doctor regretted his role in Eichmann capture. That would be unthinkable here. Israel is a country where everything is up for debate, except for Eichmann. There's no debate about Eichmann. And maybe there is something really uncomfortable about your father not only refusing to take credit for it, but thinking something about it was wrong. So one day, his father gets an invitation to come to the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, and accept an award for his part in Eichmann's capture. Everyone's invited, and Danny does not want his dad's seat empty.
I don't think I need to explain that if somebody takes part of such an operation, he should get credit. And I really, really tried to convince him to do it, to go to the Knesset and receive this certificate. And of course, my father doesn't want anything to do with it.
So the son comes up with a plan. His daughter just graduated high school and joined the army. And in Israeli society, there's mandatory military service. It's this huge source of pride for your kids to serve. So he convinces her to come in uniform on a Friday afternoon before Shabbat to have a heart-to-heart. You know, like, look at your granddaughter, the soldier in the army.
So I thought maybe I'll use the fact that she's a soldier and that'll somehow, you know, get him to agree to go.
That was their plot.
He was steadfast in his refusal. So I told him, why don't you just let us accept the certificate for you?
And right before Shabbat, his son is there, his granddaughter is there, and the doctor relents.
So me and my daughter, we went to the Knesset and received the certificate in his name.
Except the certificate did not have his name on it, because even here in Parliament, his father had figured out a way to keep his name out of the story.
The award said to Dr. Aleph. Aleph is the first initial of his last name. It's like saying Dr. E for Elian. So he accepts his dad's award, but he's about to learn a darker reason behind his father's silence. And it starts when his father gets a phone call out of the blue from an Israeli guy who says basically, "Am I speaking to Dr. Yonah Elian? You killed my father. Can we talk?"
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center. Every year, millions of people lose someone to cancer. But as an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center ranked in the country's top 4%, VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center is unrelenting in finding new ways to understand, detect, treat, and prevent cancer. Unconditionally committed to keeping loved ones in their lives. Learn more at MasseyCancerCenter.org/comprehensive.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
I'm Gregory Warner. We're back with Rough Translation. And to understand the origin of that strange phone call and how it changed things between the doctor and his son, we should tell you about a 20-year hunt by one of Israel's most famous journalists for details about a different Mossad operation that turned out to have everything to do with Eichmann. The journalist is Ronen Bergman,
the senior national security correspondent for Yediot Ahronot and a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine.
His investigation centered on a secret safe in the Israeli government archives.
And in that safe, they found a file which proved that something that was whispered as a sort of an urban legend throughout the years, something that nobody actually knew whether it's right or wrong, it's just a rumor, was in fact 100% right.
So should I say briefly what the story is?
Yes, tell me that story.
This was actually the story of an Israeli army officer. His name was Alexander Israeli. And as the story goes, this Mr. Israeli was desperate for money and turned against his country. In 1954, he flies out of Israel with a suitcase full of military secrets and offers to sell them to the Egyptian embassy in Rome.
The Mossad wanted to get him.
This is like the very first years of Israel. The Mossad is this new intelligence agency. And the head of the Mossad realizes this is a great opportunity to prove ourselves, to prove what we can do. They decide to kidnap him and bring him back to Israel to stand trial. And they recruit a legendary anesthesiologist for the job, the magician, Dr. Aleph, Dr. Yonah Elian.
The Mossad's plan may sound very familiar. Young agency wants to prove itself by kidnapping someone overseas, sedating him, and bringing him to trial. That was Eichmann's story. But Eichmann had not happened yet. This was 6 years before that.
And actually, this story is almost kind of an alternate version of the Eichmann story, in which everything that can go wrong does. This is not the Mossad that everyone has heard about. This is not a slick operation. It's an amateur job from the very beginning.
The problem was to find him. They didn't find him in Rome.
So they dispatch Israeli students to go search for him in train stations across Europe.
And it turned out to be just another fiasco because the police in two of these countries realized that something is going on.
They finally find him by accident in Vienna. But it's not until they lure him to Paris that they manage to grab him. The doctor examines him, injects him with a sedative, and as he will do later with Eichmann, he boards with him on a plane to Israel.
And this is where fiasco turns into catastrophe.
Because when they land in Israel, the guy they were supposed to bring back to stand trial is dead. The doctor's drugs somehow killed him. And this is not only a failure of the mission. The Mossad at the time had a mandate.
We do not kill Jews.
The Mossad does not kill Jews. If these details get out, this will make the Mossad look really bad.
There was by far less criticism, and there was a naive belief in the public that everything that these people are doing is good, right, and just.
The Mossad chief orders the plane flown back up over the Mediterranean Sea, and the body is tossed out of the plane. They erase his name from the army records. The guy's wife and son are never told. The only civilian in Israel who knows firsthand about this cover-up is Dr. Yonah Elian, and he's ordered to keep quiet.
50 years later, Ronen, the journalist, learns about that file in the safe and starts writing articles about this story. And that's when the doctor gets that phone call from the son of the guy who died on the airplane.
And the doctor quickly gets off that call, and then he calls his own son.
I get this phone call from my father. My father was really distraught. Tells me, listen, the son of this soldier just called me. He wants to meet with me. Do me a favor, you talk to him. So I call him up. And I told him, listen, my father's old. He doesn't want to revisit these things. He just doesn't want to. And I'm really asking you to just let this be.
Danny says he actually explained to this guy, look, my father doesn't talk to anybody. And this guy, you know, he's the son of an accused traitor. He's not going to push it.
He said, well, if at some point later he wants to talk, let me know.
So when I heard this, I called up this guy, the son of Alexander Israeli.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Boker Tov.
How are you?
I wanted to know what it was like for him, this conversation between two sons, both struggling with the doctor's silence.
You want to come here?
So we made a plan to meet.
Yeah, Monday, afternoon, late afternoon. Yeah, okay.
But then he canceled. I called again, and his wife told me it was too sensitive. He just did not want to revisit this.
Danny, the doctor's son, wanted to talk with his dad about this. But he wondered if his dad had refused to talk about his successful capture with Eichmann, how much less was he going to say about this botched operation, where he'd failed the mission? So Danny waits for his moment, and he finds his father is actually willing to talk about what happened on that terrible airplane ride.
He tells him they were in a Dakota airplane, which is a World War II cargo plane with propellers. It's unheated. It's freezing. And there's turbulence. So the cabin pressure is going up and down, and all of this affected how the sedative interacted with the patient. And that's why the man died. And this is not an emotional confession. This is more like two doctors discussing a case.
But I know that this thing, like that, this story, this incident really sat with my father. I mean, it really stayed with him.
It wasn't long after that, Danny is over at his dad's house, and his dad tells him, wait here. And he goes into his room and comes back with a plastic bag with a needle inside and tells him, this is the needle I used to put Eichmann to sleep. And Danny says he never even knew his father had kept it.
Hello. Hello. Manishma.
I went back to see Danny. So Dan just took out this silver box out of his briefcase, and he shows me the needle. Can I hold it? And it's really a striking object.
Wow.
It's made of metal. It's got a handle with a leather grip that scissors out like a switchblade.
Oh, wow.
And in my hand, the needle feels surprisingly small.
זה ממש קטן.
זה לא כזה קטן, זה ממש גדול, אם אתה שואל אותי בתור רופא. זה גם גדול, גם מסורבן.
He says, this is not a tiny thing at all. If you ask me, I'm a doctor, this is a big needle. It's unwieldy, it's hard to use, it's metal. And a metal needle can cause blood clots. but that's what he had. And on the baggie that the needle came in,
Eichmann needle, okay,
is a small sticker with a note that his father had written in English, wow, in this kind of shaky handwriting.
Eichmann needle. Ze abba shelcha katav kach?
Danny is looking at this note. This is the only piece of his dad's handwriting he has left.
It was only a few months after the doctor gave his son this needle that he killed himself. At home, alone in his house. And he left no note.
Neither Danny nor his sister thinks his death had anything to do with Eichmann. They think he was getting old and frail and depressed. I've struggled with this question, and I still wonder. It struck me that this gift of the needle was like a last will.
Wow, זה כמו צבא אחרונה או משהו, זה מין.
כן, יכול להיות.
And he says, yes, could be.
Eichmann needle, כאילו, מה? כשהוא שמר את זה, הוא לא צריך להזכיר לעצמו שזה המחד של Eichmann, אני מניח.
Danny looks at the label, and he says, it's interesting because he didn't need the reminder, but he wrote it anyway. And to him, it means his father cared about this history being preserved. Maybe he didn't want his name or his voice associated with it, but he did think this object was worth saving.
Danny and Miri, the doctor's children, they disagree about most things when it comes to their father. They disagree about whether talking more would have helped him and about how often he was gone when they were kids. They even disagree about which of them received this gift. Miri says it was her he gave it to, not her brother. But when he gave it, he left no instruction. It was up to them to decide what to do next.
My brothers regarded this as a national treasure and said that this doesn't belong to us and brought it to the museum. He said that we owe it to the country to give it to the museum.
For Danny, this was his big chance to finally get his father in the history books. He got the needle photographed in the newspaper. He called up museums to find a home for it. And eventually, Avner, the museum guy at the Mossad, found him.
I called Danny. He gave me the needle for the exhibit.
And that's where I saw the needle for the first time, in that Tel Aviv exhibit, under glass. There's just something so physical about it and intimate, and you imagine that thing in Eichmann's arm. And that was the object that made me want to learn the story of this doctor and find out who he was and what he went through. But if you go to that exhibit today, you're not going to see that needle.
After a year, he took it from me.
I'd be happy to take the needle back and put it in the exhibit. And I also offer him to honor his father and put his name in the Israeli Intelligence Center. But he didn't cooperate.
Danny decided that this needle did not belong with the Mossad's traveling show. And in this respect, he came around to his sister's point of view. Their father gave them this needle. He did not give them a story to go with it.
It was a significant needle for him. I think it meant something to him without expressing what it was.
On my last meeting, I asked Danny what the needle now means to him. Danny told me the needle is an important part of this story, but it does not replace the stories, the revelations, the confessions that never were.
In a way, this needle connects these two stories in the doctor's life, 6 years apart, where he did the exact same job for his country, injected a wanted man in a plane with such different results. In one, he was glorified in a national triumph. In the other, made complicit in a government cover-up. In one, he was asked to be a hero. In the other, a ghost. So his son decided in the end that the right place for this needle was where his dad kept it, in a drawer.
Stay in the family.
He's going to pass it on to his kids, and then it'll be on them to to decide what to do with the legacy.
Today's show was produced by Jess Jang. Marianne McCune is our editor. And so many people listened to this piece and made it better. Thank you to Larry Kaplow, Middle East editor, Karen Duffin, Quill Lawrence, Anne Hepperman, Alex Goldmark, Sana Krasikov, and Yochai Meital, who was also the interpreter for Danny Elian. Yochai is co-creator of a fantastic bilingual podcast, Israel Story. They're out with their next season in June. And Ronen Bergman wrote the book, Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Thanks also to Matt Orton for his help and to our new Rough Translation intern, Autumn Barnes. The Rough Translation executive team is Neil Carruth, Will Dobson, and Anya Grunman. Sarah Knight fact-checked this episode, mastering by Andy Huther. John Ellis composed music for our show. Marianne McCune and Mike Cruz scored the episode. If you'd like more stories like this in your podcast feed, tell a friend about the episode or write us a review. It always helps. Drop us your thoughts at roughtranslation@npr.org or on Facebook. I'm Gregory Warner, back in 2 weeks with more Rough Translation.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Schizophrenia and Psychosis Action Alliance, shattering barriers to treatment, survival, and recovery. People with schizophrenia can recover and thrive. More at wecanthrive.org. This message comes from NPR sponsor, the American Cancer Society. By the end of this message, two people will be told they have cancer. Yes, every 15 seconds, someone is diagnosed with cancer. But by the end of this message, you could do something about it with your donation. A gift of any amount to the American Cancer Society can help those facing cancer get free rides to care or a free place to stay closer to treatment. Donate today at cancer.org.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.